So good to have you with us on Air Talk today. I'm Larry Mantle, coming your way from home, as I typically do on Fridays. Film Week coming up at 11 o'clock right here on 89.3. And I want to take a moment, as I also typically do on Fridays, to thank our terrific Air Talk team. They are so good, and we owe them so much for their dedication, their talent, and just their flat-out smarts. They're a terrific team. Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, Natalie Chudnovsky, who's leading the show today, Lindsay Wright, also helping us this week, Julia Murray, and Morgan Keith, our news apprentices who work so hard providing me with all the information that I need and screening phone calls, and Manny Valladares with us, and James Chow, and our engineer, the flawless Parker McDaniels, leading things on the technical side for us on Air Talk today. My great thanks and appreciation to them for all that they do. Well, we turn our attention now to COVID-19. We have a number of significant developments to talk about on the program. Joining me to make our way through them, Dr. Timothy Brewer, epidemiologist and professor of medicine at UCLA School of Public Health. Dr. Brewer has served on the advisory boards of the World Health Organization, the National Institutes of Health, and the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Brewer, welcome back, and a very good Friday to you.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for having me.
We expect to hear today from President-elect Joe Biden what his administration's plans are for vaccine administration, which are slower than had been anticipated in these first few weeks. What are you hopeful to hear from him?
What I'd really like to hear President Biden say is we're going to loosen up the restrictions on who can get the vaccine. I think that it would be very helpful to try to increase our vaccination rates, particularly among people over the age of 65. We're seeing a lot of stress on our hospitals, and I think the sooner we can get this higher risk population vaccinated, the better.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about what we're seeing in the way of the different vaccines. I'm starting to hear from some people are saying, well, I want to wait for the AstraZeneca, or I want to get the Moderna because I think that's going to be better than the Pfizer, things like this. Can you talk a bit about whether there are significant differences, or whether the clinical trials for these vaccines showed different results for different groups?
Sure. So let's start with the two that have been approved, the Moderna and the Pfizer. So from the receiving end, from the patient or the person, and really no difference between these two vaccines. They have the same mechanism of action. They have roughly the same side effect profile, and they have the same efficacy results in clinical trials, meaning they work just as well as each other. While they have very important differences in terms of how they were manufactured and need to be handled, those really aren't concerns for people receiving vaccines. In terms of the AstraZeneca vaccine, that's not available yet, so I wouldn't wait to get vaccinated if you have the opportunity to be vaccinated. In terms of its effectiveness, it's probably as effective as the other two, but in preventing serious disease and hospitalizations, but I think we'll need to wait to see in terms of the logistics about how easy it is to roll out.
Why is it taking so long to get approval of that AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine? Because if I'm not mistaken, the UK approved that several weeks ago. I know there were some issues about the clinical trial and the size of the dosage and all that. But why do you think it's taking these extra weeks?
I don't know. I don't know where it stands in terms of whether or not they've submitted the data to the FDA or not. The data have been published. They're publicly available to review. There was, at one of the five sites that the vaccine was tried, the mistake in terms of the dosing, and that certainly does raise some concerns as to whether the entire trial was done properly or not. But these are the kinds of things that the FDA would be able to assess, have they been given the information from the company.
All right, we're talking with Dr. Timothy Brewer, UCLA School of Public Health, where he's professor, also noted epidemiologist, and our phone lines are open for your questions about coronavirus vaccination, about COVID-19 and the stress on our hospitals here in Southern California. Anything else you want to ask about where we are medically, epidemiologically with the pandemic? 866-893-KPCC. 866-893-5722. You can comment on the AirTalk page or ask your question there. Tweet at AirTalk or post on our AirTalk Facebook page, and we bring together all those different questions for you. Dr. Brewer, the Centers for Disease Control said this morning that that strain from the UK, which appears might be somewhat more contagious, even if it isn't more serious in the symptoms that it produces, that could end up being the dominant strain here in the U.S. by March. What do you think of that assessment?
Well, that's certainly possible. So this is actually not the first time that the coronavirus has changed and a dominant strain has taken over. So there was another mutation called D614G, which took place actually early on in the pandemic, initially described in Europe, and then rapidly became the dominant strain pretty much around the world. Similar to the B117 that has now been described in the UK, more transmissible, but not at all more virulent, and did not seem to cause more severe symptoms. So it's certainly possible that B117 could become a dominant strain over time.
And both the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are strongly thought to be thoroughly effective against the new strain.
As far as we know, so the only data I've seen are actually out of the University of Texas Galveston, which was part of the Pfizer trial. And what they did is they took the serum from 20 vaccinated individuals who had participated in the trial, and they looked at the variant virus, the B117, and they found that the antibodies did work against that strain just as it had against the wild strain. So those are the only data I'm aware of, but it is suggestive that the vaccine should work against this new variant.
Let's talk with Victor in Alhambra. Victor, good to have you with us on Air Talk. Your question for Dr. Brewer.
Yes, thank you, Larry. Question, or it's really a comment. I am going to be looking to take only the Moderna vaccine because I do not feel confident that the chain of custody, and specifically being able to keep the Pfizer vaccine at 94 degrees below zero throughout the entire process, I don't feel comfortable that can be done in a way that I would be able to validate it and verify it along the way. So Moderna,
Victor,
being able to be
kept, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, with Moderna being able to be kept in a regular freezer, I feel comfortable with that.
Yeah. Dr. Brewer, so I think a lot of people, particularly initially, had that perspective, but I was impressed with all the different safeguards and alert systems that Pfizer has on these supplies of vaccine. Can you walk us through what they've done to try and make sure what Victor's concerned about doesn't happen?
Sure. So first off, so I got the Pfizer vaccine, so that's the one that I was given through my hospital. What they do, Victor, is they actually put temperature sensors in all the vaccine boxes that are shipped around the country. And so when the pharmacists receive those boxes and they open them up, they can immediately tell whether or not the vaccine has gotten out of an acceptable range or not. So essentially what they're doing is they're putting in markers to make sure that at any point in the supply chain, if there is a break in the handling, those markers will then flag that these doses need to be either gotten rid of or somehow examined. So I think the logistics have been very well taken care of, but it is a challenge to get these vaccines distributed.
Victor, appreciate your call very much. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Now, Dr. Brewer, if only wine lovers had that kind of a temperature indicator, you know, when wine is shipped during the summer, it can go bad and you would never know it till you open the bottle. So they need a little pop-up thing like that, like the Pfizer
there
vaccine.
You go.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Kirk tweets at AirTalk, today, according to LA County Public Health, the third of county residents have been exposed to COVID-19. LA County refuses to vaccinate independently living seniors over 75, much less those over 65, till after optometry clinics, acupuncturists and chiropractors are vaccinated. I'm an MD. How does this protect the most vulnerable? Kirk, thanks very much for tweeting that. Dr. Brewer, what is the justification for LA County deciding everybody who has any medical occupation whatsoever must be vaccinated regardless of age before people who are in far more vulnerable age groups?
So I think this is where judgment comes into play. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the State Public Health Department, and others have made recommendations. We have this tier system on the order of who should be vaccinated, with the 1A tier being health, frontline healthcare workers like myself, plus people over the age of 75 in congregate settings. I would agree with Kurt. I think the challenge facing us is we need to figure out how to get these vaccines into individuals 65 and older faster. I think one of the things we need to do is try to protect people who are most likely to get serious disease and hospitalized because of the tremendous strain that we're seeing on our healthcare system. So I agree with Kirk that I would revisit that question and wonder, shouldn't we be pushing these vaccines out more quickly to those 65 and older?
And I had thought that that was part of the federal guidelines. I was asking Dr. Ferrer, our director of public health in LA County, about this on Wednesday evening. And it wasn't clear to me if this is just her department's policy independently on this, or if this California state policy, that everybody who works in any health-related profession ends up getting precedence over people that are over 75 years of age. Because I don't think anybody, Dr. Brewer, takes issue with people who are frontline healthcare employees or people, for example, doing house cleaning services, working in hospitals, because they're, of course, at high risk of exposure. So, and that takes a lot of jobs in the healthcare profession that it's absolutely vital that they be first in line. But then you're getting down, you know, many layers removed after that. Let's see. We have a question from Manny in West Hollywood, who says, why not distribute the vaccines to pharmacies throughout the county and do a first come, first serve type method?
So one of the challenges there, Manny, first is just availability of the vaccine. So you may have seen in some of the news reports that there was thought to be this supply of vaccine that was being held back by the federal government, but in fact, that probably is not true, and all the available vaccine has been distributed. So while states are still getting their allocations, there isn't extra vaccine to give out. So I think that's one of the challenges, is just there's not more vaccine out there. And then apropos the earlier question, particularly with the Pfizer vaccine, you do want to make sure that you're handling that vaccine appropriately. And so that requires having the minus 80 freezers to be able to store it properly until it's ready for use. And that's probably doesn't exist in a routine pharmacy.
What do you, well, actually, I'm going to break and then we'll continue. I want to hear what you think of this estimate that one in three Los Angeles County residents has had COVID-19. Now, a high percentage of those asymptomatically, of course, and would have never even known that they had COVID-19. We'll continue with UCLA's Dr. Timothy Brewer. It's Air Talk on KPECC as we head into the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. 3-day weekend. We'll be back in 90 seconds. Your questions for Dr. Timothy Brewer, epidemiologist and professor at the UCLA School of Public Health. You can tweet them at AirTalk. You can post them on the AirTalk Facebook page or call 866-893-KPECC. Coming up in about 20 minutes on Film Week, our critics have a number of documentaries to review, including one on America's largest retirement community, Some Kind of Heaven. Also, Night Stalker, The Hunt for a Serial Killer. It's a Netflix docuseries looking at the terror that was inflicted by the Night Stalker serial killer during the 1980s here in Southern California. That's coming up on Film Week at 11 o'clock right here on KPECC. Dr. Brewer, what do you think of the LA County estimate that one in three county residents have had COVID-19, whether they knew it or not?
So that sounds a little high to me. So the CDC has been doing seroprevalence studies. The last one that I saw was published in November in JAMA. And at least when you look at these across all 50 states, the range is running between 1 and 23%, but most of them are in the 4 to 10% range. Now, obviously, we've had a lot more COVID since November, so it's going to be higher. But whether it's actually up to 33% or not, I'm not so sure.
All right. Jeff in the North Valley says, I just got tested at San Fernando Recreation Park yesterday, and they're still using the curative tests. I thought LA was discontinuing their partnership with curative. Is there a risk of false negative results? And how soon will they replace the curative tests with another partner, if at all? That's Jeff in the North Valley.
So I don't know how the county decides which test to use. So the concern, Jeff, may be, so the B.1.1.7 variant of the coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, does have a deletion in it, meaning it's missing a little piece of the genetic code for the spike protein, and that can sometimes give a false negative on PCR tests that focus primarily on the spike protein genome. However, most of the PCR tests available actually target two different parts of the virus, the spike protein and the nucleocapsid. So in general, the test should be okay.
All right. Stock with Larry in Long Beach. Good to have you with us on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. It's Larry Cosman, your mother's neighbor.
Oh, hi, Larry. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Question is, I got the Moderna shot on Monday and in Huntington Beach because I'm a healthcare professional, plus I'm with the Orange County Health Department. So they sent us over there to get it and went on the website, got an appointment, went in, got through the whole thing. Then at the end, I asked them the question, okay, how do I set up for my follow-up after February 8th? And everybody said, we don't know. And they said, I guess they'll send us an email. I said, well, will they send us an email? And they said, we don't know. So since then, I tried to get on the Athena app site to see if there's any information for me at all. And there, you just can't even get on the site. It just, you have to keep changing your password. It doesn't recognize it. I thought maybe it was just because I was old and the computer was a problem. But
hardly, Larry. So they, you just couldn't get any information about your second injection of the vaccine. Larry, hang on. Dr. Brewer, have you heard about this problem where people haven't been told that they're going to get a follow-up email or text or some sort of notification to come in for the second injection?
So I have not, but that's very concerning. I must admit, I think my hospital handled it very well. And so when I got my first dose I could immediately sign up for my second dose right then and there. But how it's being handled outside of hospital systems, I'm not sure. But that's very concerning that they don't have a plan in place for getting the second dose. And I hope somebody is addressing that quickly.
Now, is there a problem if Larry's not able to get in for his subsequent shot? Let's say it takes 2 months or 3 months. Is the efficacy of his overall protection in any way impinged by, aside from that, the interim period, the period between the first and the vaccine? Once he's had the second vaccine, would he be covered as well as if he would have had it, say, 4 weeks later?
So we don't have any data yet, except for the AstraZeneca vaccine. So if you look at the AstraZeneca vaccine data that have been published, in fact, most people did not get the second dose within the requisite time frame, and it was delayed up to as much as 6 or 7 weeks after the first, and seemed to have no impact on the efficacy. No data for the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines that I'm aware of. But if we look at other multi-dose vaccines that we have available to us, like hepatitis B, usually it's not a problem if the second dose is delayed. But again, no data that I'm aware of yet for the COVID-19 vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna.
All right, Larry, thanks for your call, and good luck in getting some information on your follow-up shot of the Moderna vaccine. Larry in Long Beach, our lines are open for you at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dr. Brewer, we've had a couple of questions that relate to what's called shedding of the virus and concerns that, you know, people, once they've been vaccinated and have their own immunity to COVID-19, that it still could be possible for them to shed virus and infect other people, in a sense, being a carrier and passing it on through droplets to others. How much of a risk is that?
So we don't know, but I think that's a real concern, and studies are underway to try and figure that out. There are some limited data from the AstraZeneca trial to suggest that it did prevent asymptomatic infection, and that's part of why the efficacy results were a little bit different. In the Pfizer and Moderna trials, they didn't look at that. But historically, we know this can happen. So, for example, the Salk polio vaccine was very good at preventing people from getting polio, but it did not prevent transmission of polio to others. And that's why we needed the Sabin oral vaccine to be able to interrupt transmission. So we're going to have to wait for the data, and they're studying that right now, to see if these vaccines actually prevent transmission in addition to preventing disease.
We've also had a number of questions about pregnancy, either for women who are in the process of attempting to get pregnant or who are currently pregnant. Is there any reason they should delay being vaccinated because of that?
So no evidence to suggest that these vaccines cause any problems in pregnancy. And in fact, while pregnancy was an exclusion criteria for the trials, there were a couple of women who did end up being pregnant during the time. So the best thing to do is discuss it with your healthcare provider, but there's no evidence to suggest that these vaccines have any risk for pregnant women or developing fetuses.
Ethan tweets at AirTalk, why is California falling behind other states in the vaccine rollout? We've had a lower percentage of our vaccines on hand actually administered to people than the typical other state. Why is that, Dr. Brewer?
I would love to know the answer, Ethan. If you'd find out, please let me know. That would be a terrific question to ask the state public health department.
And one wonders if they would have a satisfactory answer. We'll continue with Dr. Timothy Brewer, UCLA School of Public Health, where he's professor, noted epidemiologist as well. 866 1-800-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Film Week is 10 minutes away. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with Dr. Timothy Brewer, UCLA School of Public Health. Renee says, my husband read a recommendation in Vox that we shouldn't go to the grocery store anymore. I really can't afford to use one of those shopping services like Instacart. Plus, you can't shop for deals within the store. We generally shop late at night within the last hour before closing with fewer people there, wear masks and sanitize. Do we really have to stop shopping? That's Renee in Pasadena. Dr. Brewer?
So Renee, risk of transmission is based on how close you are to other people, how much time you spend with them, whether you're indoors or outdoors, and whether or not you've taken any mitigating factors, such as are you wearing a mask and are they wearing a mask. So it sounds like you're doing the right kinds of things, which is if you need to go to the store, and obviously we need to have groceries, and you can't afford to use either curbside pickup or a delivery service, try to go at a time when there are fewer people there. Try to minimize the amount of time that you spend in the store. Make sure that you're keeping your distance from others in the store and wash your hands when you get home. And of course, obviously, always wear your face mask while you're in the store or outside of the house.
Los Angeles County is reportedly considering closing non-essential retail establishments, including shopping malls and other stores. This obviously would not affect grocery stores and those that are providing essential goods. I assume this would be similar to the retail shutdown that we saw back in March, the early weeks of the pandemic. Dr. Brewer, do you think the science would justify that? Do you think we're likely seeing spread of the coronavirus in these retail establishments?
Well, what we do know is probably the vast majority of transmission does occur in indoor settings rather than outdoor settings, and that's both retail and in the home. The second thing we know is that even though case numbers have stabilized a little bit in the last week or so, we're at extremely high rates of COVID transmission, much higher than we were in March. And deaths have not really stabilized at all. So deaths have continued to go up both in the state and in the county. Hospitalizations are still at an extremely high level. On the good side, we know the vaccines are becoming available. And so if we can get through this period of the next few weeks or month or so, that may actually help us to protect our hospitals and our vulnerable populations. The other piece in all of this is there will be a new administration within a week, and hopefully there will be economic relief for those individuals who need it, which will make it easier to do these kinds of broader shutdowns to hopefully get everything under control.
Joe Biden's proposal is a new nearly $2 trillion plan to deal with the pandemic economy. We have a question from a listener in Long Beach wondering about if you're not able to get that second dose of the vaccine for an extended period of time, what degree of protection do you have in the interim?
So very limited data so far, but what we do know is that the protections from the first dose starts to develop about 2 weeks after the first dose or so. There is some preliminary data to suggest that one dose gives you about 50% efficacy, at least in the short term, but all of the studies really are using the two dose. So even if you're delayed in getting that second dose, you should make every effort to get that second dose. Even if you can't get it at the 3 week or the 4 week mark, which is clearly the preferred way to do it, do try to make sure you get that second dose eventually.
But it's unclear to what extent we have protection in that interim period.
That's exactly right. There probably is some protection, but the level of protection is not clear at this point.
Denise, listening on the island of Kauai, says, I've heard people say they're waiting for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to get emergency use authorization because it is a different type of vaccine. Can Dr. Brewer elaborate on those differences?
So, Denise, Johnson & Johnson is a viral-based vaccine, which means that they take the genetic material, they stick it inside of a virus that cannot cause disease, and then let the virus introduce the genetic material into the cell and create the spike protein that generates the immune response. This is an approach that's been used for decades. We know that it works, and we know that it's safe. It has some advantages, and it doesn't require the freezer capacity that the mRNA vaccines do. It's a more stable vaccine. However, if you have the opportunity to get the vaccines currently that have been approved, I would go ahead and get vaccinated.
I want to apologize. There are so many questions coming in today, and I'm not going to be able to get to all of them. And I'm trying to pick the ones that I think have the most people asking them or would have the broadest applicability. So my apologies that I can't get through so many of these. But Dr. Brewer, a couple of people have asked about, speaking of the spike protein, how the UK variant strain, what is the way that it seems to attach itself more effectively than the earlier variant, making it easier to contract?
Sure. So there's a change in the genetic code for the spike protein. We call that a mutation. The particular mutation in this variant is called N501Y, but all that means is that you're substituting a different amino acid in the 501 position on the spike protein, and that makes it a little stickier to the ACE2 receptor. And so that's probably why it transmits better than the previous variants. But it, as I said, these kinds of changes have happened before.
Dr. Brewer, thank you so much for taking this time with us on Air Talk. We really appreciate it, and we wish you a terrific weekend.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of your colleagues at UCLA Health for the tremendous services you're providing. Dr. Timothy Brewer, epidemiologist, professor of medicine at the UCLA School of Public Health. Coming up next, it's Film Week. Air Talk is off Monday for the MLK holiday. We'll have a special presentation of 1A coming up at 10 Monday.